The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll be reading from the January-February 2018 issue of Smithsonian Magazine titled 1968, The Year That Shattered America. We'll begin with an article titled The Ghosts of My Lie by Sean Raviv. In the hamlet where U.S. troops killed hundreds of men, women, and children, survivors are ready to forgive the most infamous American soldier of the war. William Laws Calley, Jr. was never really meant to be an officer in the U.S. Army. After getting low grades and dropping out of Palm Beach Junior College, he tried to enlist in 1964, but was rejected because of a hearing defect. 2 years later, with the escalation in Vietnam, standards for enrollees changed, and Calley, neither a valedictorian nor a troublemaker, just a fairly typical American young man trying to figure out what to do with his life, was called up. Before the decade was over, Second Lieutenant Calley would become one of the most controversial figures in the country, if not the world. On March 16, 1968, during a roughly four-hour operation in the Vietnamese village of Son Mai, American soldiers killed approximately 504 civilians, including pregnant women and infants, gang-raped women, and burned a village to ashes. Calley, though a low-ranking officer in Charlie Company, stood out because of the sheer number of civilians he was accused of killing and ordering killed. The red-haired Miami native, known to friends as Rusty, became the face of the massacre, which was named after one of the sub-hamlets where the killings took place, My Lai 4. His story dominated headlines, along with the Apollo 12 moon landing and the trial of Charles Manson. His case became a kind of litmus test for American values, a question not only of who was to blame for My Lai, but how America should conduct war and what constitutes a war crime. Out of the roughly 200 soldiers who were dropped into the village that day, 24 were later charged with criminal offenses, and only one was convicted, Calley. He was set free after serving less than 4 years. Since that time, Calley has almost entirely avoided the press. Now 74 years old, he declined to be interviewed for this story, but I was able to piece together a picture of his life and legacy by reviewing court records and interviewing his fellow soldiers and close friends. I traveled to Son Mai, where survivors are still waiting for him to come back and make amends. And I visited Columbus, Georgia, where Calley lived for nearly 30 years. I wanted to know whether Calley, a convicted mass murderer and one of the most notorious figures in 20th century history, had ever expressed true contrition or lived a normal life. The landscape surrounding Son Mai is still covered with rice paddies, as it was 50 years ago. There are still water buffalo fertilizing the fields and chickens roaming. Most of the roads are still dirt. On a recent Wednesday afternoon, 10 young men were drinking beer and smoking cigarettes at the side of one of those roads. A karaoke machine was set up on a motorbike, and the loudspeakers were placed next to a blink-and-you-miss-it plaque with an arrow pointing to a mass grave of 75 victims. Tran Nam was 6 years old when he heard gunshots from inside his mud and straw home in Son Mai. It was early morning, and he was having breakfast with his extended family. 14 people in all. The U.S. Army had come to the village a couple of times previously during the war. Nam's family thought it would be like before. They'd be gathered and interviewed and then let go. So the family kept on eating. Then a U.S. soldier stepped in, Nam told me, and he aimed into our meal and shot. People collapsed one by one. Nam saw the bullet-ridden bodies of his family falling, his grandfather, his parents, his older brother, his younger brother, his aunt, and cousins. He ran into a dimly lit bedroom and hid under the bed. He heard more soldiers enter the house and then more gunshots. He stayed under the bed as long as he could, but that wasn't long because the Americans set the house on fire. When the heat grew unbearable, Nam ran out the door and hid in a ditch as his village burned. Of the 14 people at breakfast that morning, 13 were shot and 11 killed. Only Nam made it out physically unscathed. The six U.S. Army platoons that swept through Son Mai that day included 100 men from Charlie Company and 100 from Bravo Company. They killed some civilians straight off, shooting them point-blank or tossing grenades into their homes. In the words of Arnando Simpson, a member of 2nd Platoon who was interviewed for the book 4 Hours in My Lai, "I cut their throats, cut off their hands, cut out their tongue, their hair, scalped them. I did it. A lot of people were doing it and I just followed. I lost all sense of direction." Simpson went on to commit suicide. Soldiers gathered together villagers along a trail going through the village and also along an irrigation ditch to the east. Callie and 20-year-old Private First Class Paul Medlow mowed the people down with M16s, burning through several clips in the process. The soldiers killed as many 200 people in those two areas of Son Mai, including 79 children. Witnesses said Callie also shot a praying Buddhist monk and a young Vietnamese woman with her hands up. When he saw a 2-year-old boy who had crawled out of the ditch, Callie threw the child back in and shot him. Truong Thi Le, then a rice farmer, told me she was hiding in her home with her 6-year-old son and 17-year-old daughter when the Americans found them and dragged them out. When the soldiers fired an M16 into their group, most died then and there. Le fell on top of her son and 2 bodies fell on top of her. Hours later, they emerged from the pile alive. "When I noticed that it was quiet, I pushed the dead bodies above me aside," she told me. "Blood was all over my head, my clothes." She dragged her son to the edge of a field and covered him with rice and cloth. "I told him not to cry or they would come to kill us." When I asked about her daughter, Lei, who had maintained her composure up until that point, covered her face with her hands and broke down in tears. She told me that Tu was killed along with 104 people at the trail, but didn't die right away. When it was safe to move, Lee found Tu sitting and holding her grandmother, who was already dead. "Mom, I'm bleeding a lot," Lei remembers her daughter saying. "I have to leave you." Nguyen Hong Man, 13 at the time of the massacre, told me he went into an underground tunnel with his 5-year-old niece to hide, only to watch her get shot right in front of him. "I lay there horrified," he said. "Blood from the nearby bodies splashed onto my body. People who were covered with a lot of blood and stayed got the chance to survive, while kids did not. Many of them died as they cried for their parents in terror." Initially, the U.S. Army portrayed the massacre as a great victory over Viet Cong forces, and that story might not have been challenged had it not been for a helicopter gunner named Ronald Reidenhauer. He wasn't there himself, but a few weeks after the operation, his friends from Charlie Company told him about the mass killing of civilians. He did some investigating on his own and then waited until he finished his service. Just over a year after the massacre, Reidenhauer sent a letter to about 24 members of Congress, the Secretaries of State and Defense, the Secretary of the Army, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, telling them about a 2nd Lieutenant Callie who had machine-gunned groups of unarmed citizens. Reidenhauer's letter spurred the Inspector General of the Army, General William Enemark, to launch a fact-finding mission led by Colonel William Wilson. At a hotel in Terre Haute, Indiana, Wilson spoke to Medlow, the soldier who was with Callie who had gunned down rows of villagers. Medlow had been discharged from the Army because of a severe injury. Like many others who'd been at Son Mai, he was essentially granted immunity when the investigation began. As he described what he'd done and witnessed, he looked at the ceiling and wept. "We just started wiping out the whole village," he told Wilson. A subsequent inquiry by the Army's Criminal Investigation Command discovered that military photographer Ronald Haberly had taken photos during the operation. In a hotel room in Ohio, before a stunned investigator, Haberly projected on a hung-up bedsheet horrifying images of piled dead bodies and frightened Vietnamese villagers. Armed with Haberly's photos and 1,000 pages of testimony from 36 witnesses, the Army officially charged Callie with premeditated murder, just one day before he was scheduled to be discharged. 18 months later, in March 1971, a court-martial with a jury of six fellow officers, including five who had served in Vietnam, found Cali guilty of murdering at least 22 civilians and sentenced him to life in prison. The day the verdict came down, Cali defended his actions in a statement to the court. "My troops were getting massacred and mauled by an enemy I couldn't see, I couldn't feel, and I couldn't touch, that nobody in the military system ever described them as anything other than communism. They didn't give it a race, they didn't give it a sex, they didn't give it an age. They never let me believe it was just a philosophy in a man's mind. That was my enemy out there." Despite the overwhelming evidence that Cali had personally killed numerous civilians, a survey found that nearly 4 out of 5 Americans disagreed with his guilty verdict. His name became a rallying cry on both the right and the left. Hawks said Cali had been simply doing his job. Dove said Cali had taken the fall for generals and politicians who dragged America into a disastrous and immoral conflict. In newspaper articles around the world, one word became intertwined with Cali's name: scapegoat. Within 3 months of the verdict, the White House received more than 300,000 letters and telegrams, almost all in support of the convicted soldier. Cali himself received 10,000 letters and packages a day. His military defense counsel, Major Kenneth Raby, who spent 19 months working on the court-martial, told me Cali received so much mail that he had to be moved to a ground-floor apartment at Fort Benning, where the deliveries didn't have to be carried up the stairs. Some of Cali's supporters went to great lengths. Two musicians from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, released a recording called The Battle Hymn of Lieutenant Cali, which included the line, "There's no other way to wage a war." It sold more than 1 million copies. Digger Odell, a professional showman based in Columbus, Georgia, buried himself alive for 79 days in a used car lot. A passerby could drop a coin into a tube that led down to Odell's grave, with the proceeds going toward a fund for Cali. He later welded shut the doors of his car, refusing to come out until Cali was set free. Politicians, noting the anger of their constituents, made gestures of their own. Indiana Governor Edgar Whitcomb ordered the state's flags to fly at half-staff. Governor John Bell Williams of Mississippi said his state was about ready to secede from the Union over the Cali verdict. Governor Jimmy Carter, the future president, urged his fellow Georgians to honor the flag as Rusty had done. Local leaders across the country demanded that President Nixon pardon Cali. Nixon fell short of a pardon, but he ordered that Cali remain under house arrest in his apartment at Fort Benning, where he could play badminton in the backyard and hang out with his girlfriend. After a series of appeals, Cali's sentence was cut from life to 20 years, then in half to 10 years. He was set free in November 1974 after serving 3.5 years, most of it at his apartment. In the months after his release, Cali made a few public appearances and then moved a 20-minute drive down the road to Columbus, Georgia, where he disappeared into private life. Situated along the Chattahoochee River, Columbus is first and foremost a military town. Its residents' lives are linked to Fort Benning, which has served as a home of the U.S. Infantry School since 1918 and today supports more than 100,000 civilian and military personnel. "The Army is just a part of day-to-day life here," the longtime Columbus journalist Richard Hyatt told me, and back in the day, William Cali was part of that life. Bob Poydashev, the former mayor of Columbus, says that there was controversy when Cali moved to town. "There were many of us who were just horrified," he told me, raising his voice until he was almost shouting. "It's just not done. You don't go and kill unarmed civilians." Still, Cali became a familiar face around Columbus. In 1976, he married Penny Vick, whose family owned a jewelry shop frequented by members of Columbus's elite. One of their wedding guests was U.S. District Judge J. Robert Elliott, who had tried to get Cali's conviction overturned 2 years earlier. After the wedding, Cali began working at the jewelry shop. He took classes to improve his knowledge of gemstones and got trained to make appraisals to increase the store's business. In the 1980s, he applied for a real estate license and was initially denied because of his criminal record. He asked Reed Kennedy, the judge who had presided over his court-martial, if he'd write him a letter. He did so, and Cali got the license while continuing to work at the shop. "It's funny, isn't it, that a man who breaks into your house and steals your TV will never get a license, but a man who's convicted of killing 22 people can get one," Kennedy told the Columbus Ledger-Inquirer in 1988. Al Fleming, a former local TV news anchor, described Callie as a soft-spoken man. When I met Fleming in Columbus over a steak dinner, one of the first things he told me was, "I'm not going to say anything bad about Rusty Callie. He and I were best friends for a long time. We still are, as far as I'm concerned." Callie left town some years back and now lives in Gainesville, Florida. Fleming described how Callie used to sit with him at the restaurant he owned, Fleming's Primetime Grill, and talk late into the night about Vietnam. He told Fleming that Charlie Company had been sent to My Lai to scorch the earth, and that even years after his conviction, he still felt he'd done what he'd been ordered to do. After our dinner, Fleming gave me a tour in his tiny red Fiat, pausing to point out the house where Callie lived for nearly 30 years. He also pointed out an estate nearby that had appeared in The Green Berets, a pro-war 1968 film starring John Wayne. The Army had participated heavily in the production, providing uniforms, helicopters, and other equipment. The battle scenes were filmed at Fort Benning, and a house in Columbus was used as a stand-in for a Viet Cong general's villa. In the 1980s, the Green Beret house caught fire. When the neighbors rushed out to form a bucket brigade, Callie was right there with everyone else, trying to put out the flames. During his time in Columbus, Callie mostly succeeded in keeping himself out of the national spotlight. Hyatt, the journalist, used to go to V.V. Vic Jewelers every few years on the anniversary of the massacre to try to get an interview with Callie, but was always politely denied. Callie and Penny had one son, William Laws Callie III, known as Laws, who went on to get a Ph.D. in electrical engineering at Georgia Tech. But the divorce documents I found at the Muskogee County Clerk's office present a dismal picture. According to a legal brief filed by Callie's attorney in 2008, he spent most of his adult years feeling powerless both at work and at home. It states that Callie did all the cooking and all the cleaning that wasn't done by the maid, and that he was their son's primary caretaker. The jewelry store, according to the document, was his life, and except for his son, where he had derived his self-worth. He even worked hard to try to infuse new ideas into the store to help it grow and be more profitable, all of which were rejected by Mrs. Callie. In 2004, his wife, who inherited the store from her parents, stopped paying him a salary. He fell into a depression and moved to Atlanta to stay with Laws, living off his life savings until it was gone. Callie and his son remained close. The divorce documents provide little information about Penny Vic's side of the story apart from two ambiguous details. Vic and Laws also declined to be interviewed for this story. His lawyer disputed one assertion, that Callie, quote, had been backing away from his marital relationship, unquote, prior to the separation, but confirmed the other assertion, that Callie consumed alcoholic beverages in his own area of the home on a daily basis. In a strange twist, John Parton, the lawyer who represented Callie's wife in the divorce, was a former Army captain who served as an assistant prosecutor in Callie's court-martial. "I'm proud of what we did," Parton told me, referring to the nearly 2 years he spent trying to put Callie in prison. He and his co-counsel called about 100 witnesses to testify against Callie. When Nixon intervened to keep Callie out of jail, Parton wrote a letter to the White House saying that the special treatment accorded a convicted murderer had defiled and degraded the military justice system. By the time the divorce was settled, according to the court documents, Callie was suffering from prostate cancer and gastrointestinal problems. His lawyer described his earning capacity as zero based upon his age and health. He asked Penny for a lump sum alimony sum of $200,000. Half of their home equity, half of the individual retirement account in Penny's name, two baker shelves, and a cracked porcelain bird that apparently had emotional significance. The closest Callie ever came to publicly apologizing for My Lai was at a 2009 meeting of the Kiwanis Club of Greater Columbus. Fleming set up the talk on a Wednesday afternoon. No reporters were invited, but a retired local newsman surreptitiously blogged about it online, and the local paper picked up the story. "There is not a day that goes by that I do not feel remorse for what happened that day in My Lai," Callie told the 50 or so Kiwanis members. "I feel remorse for the Vietnamese who were killed, for their families, for the American soldiers involved in their families. I'm very sorry." The historian Howard Jones, author of My Lai, Vietnam, 1968 and The Descent into Darkness, read Callie's words in news reports but didn't believe they showed true contrition. "There was just no inner change of heart," Jones told me. "I mean, it just wasn't there, no matter how people tried to paint it." Jones especially took issue with the fact that Kelly insisted in the Kiwanis speech that he'd only been following orders. It's still unclear exactly what Captain Ernest L. Medina told the men of Charlie Company the night before they were helicoptered into Sun Mai. He did not respond to interview requests for the story. The captain reportedly told his soldiers that they were finally going to meet the Viet Cong's 48th Local Force Battalion, a well-armed division of at least 250 soldiers, which for months had tormented them. Medina later claimed that he never told his men to kill innocent civilians. He testified at Cali's court-martial that Cali had hemmed and hawed before admitting the extent of the slaughter. He said Cali told him, 2 days after the massacre, "I can still hear them screaming." Medina himself was charged, tried, and found innocent. "I tried to get first-hand reports from Charlie Company men who were at Sun Mai, so I started making calls and writing letters. I eventually reached five former soldiers willing to speak on the record. Dennis Bunning, a former private first class and second platoon who now lives in California, remembered Medina's pep talk this way: 'We're going to get even with them for all the losses we've had. We're going to get in there, we're killing everything that's alive, we're throwing the bodies down the wells, we're burning the villages, and we're wiping them off the map.'" It would have been a compelling message for young men who had spent the previous months getting attacked by invisible forces. They had lost friends to booby traps, landmines, and sniper fire. By March 16th, Charlie Company alone had suffered 28 casualties, 5 dead, and many others permanently maimed, without once engaging directly with an enemy combatant. "Most of everything that was going on was insanity in my view. It was trying to survive," says Lawrence LaCroix of Utah, who was only 18 when he went into Sun Mai as a 2nd Platoon squad leader. "The problem is, when you step on a mine or a booby trap, there's nothing to take your anger out on. It's not like a firefight when you get to shoot back. You can't shoot a mine. It doesn't really care. All of your friends are getting killed and there's nobody to fight," echoed John Smale, 3rd Platoon squad leader, now living in Washington State. "So when we thought we had a chance to meet them head-on, we were pumped." Kenneth Hodges, a former sergeant who is now living in rural Georgia, told me he was devastated when he heard of Callie's partial apology at the Columbus Kiwanis Club. "I felt like crying, really, because he had nothing to apologize for," said Hodges. "I know today I don't have anything to apologize for. I went to Vietnam, and I served 2 tours, and I served honorably. On that particular operation, I carried out the order as it was issued. A good soldier receives, obeys, and carries out the orders that he has issued, and he reports back. That's the way it was in 68. That was the way I was trained." In contrast, Medlow expressed intense remorse. He is living in Indiana, and he says that as he gets older, the memories of My Lai come back more frequently, not less. "When I'm sleeping, I can actually see the faces, and that's the honest-to-God truth," he told me. "I can actually see the faces and the terror in all those people's eyes, and I wake up and I'm just shaking and I just can't hardly cope with it. The nightmares and everything will never go away. I'm sure of that, but I have to live with it." Medlow stood 10 to 15 away from a group of villagers and went through at least 4 clips of 17 bullets each. "He almost certainly killed relatives of the people I spoke with in Vietnam. It might have been Medlow's bullets that struck T. Lay's daughter, or his Zippo that burned Tran Nam's house." The day after that massacre, Medlow stepped onto a landmine as right foot was blown off. As he was whisked away in a helicopter, Medlow reportedly shouted, "Why did you do it? This is God's punishment to me, Callie, but you'll get yours. God will punish you, Callie." Medlow is still angry at the U.S. government for sending him to Vietnam in the first place, but he says he no longer holds a grudge against Callie. "I think he believed that he was doing his duty and doing his job when he was over there," he told me. "He might have got sidetracked." Tran Nam, the Sun Mai villager, who hid under a bed as a 6-year-old while his family fell around him, is now 56 years old. He works as a gardener at the Sun Mai Vestige Site, a small museum dedicated to the memory of all those killed in 1968. The garden contains the brick bases of 18 of the 247 homes that were otherwise destroyed that day. In front of each is a plaque with the name of the family that lived there and the list of the members of the family who were killed. Inside the museum, items that once belonged to the people of Sun Mai sit in glass cases. The rosary beads and Buddhist prayer book of the 65-year-old monk Du Ngo, the round-bellied fish sauce pot of 40-year-old Nguyen T. Chuck, the iron sickle of 29-year-old Fung T. Muong, a single slipper of 6-year-old Tru T. Kai, and the stone marbles of 2 younger brothers. One case displays a hairpin that belonged to 15-year-old Nguyen T. Hyun. Her boyfriend held on to it for 8 years after the massacre before donating it to the museum. At the museum's entrance is a large black marble plaque that bears the names and ages of every person killed in Sun Mai on March 16, 1968. The list includes 17 pregnant women and 210 children under the age of 13. Turn left and there is a diorama of how the village looked before every dwelling was burned down. The walls are lined with Ronald Haberle's graphic photos, as well as pictures of Calley and other soldiers known to have committed atrocities, including Medlow and Hodges. American heroes are celebrated like Ronald Ridenhour, the ex-GI who first exposed the killings. He died in 1998. And Hugh Thompson, a pilot, and Lawrence Colburn, a gunner, who saved 9 or 10 civilians that day of the massacre by airlifting them on their helicopter. Both Thompson and Colburn later died of cancer. There are also photos of former U.S. soldiers who have visited the museum, including a Vietnam veteran named Billy Kelly, who has 504 roses delivered to the museum on the anniversary of the massacre every year. Sometimes he brings them personally. The director of the museum, Pham Tron Kong, is a survivor himself. He was 11 years old when he and his family heard the American shooting and hid in a tunnel underneath his house. As the soldiers approached, Kong's mother told him and his four siblings to move deeper inside. A member of the U.S. Army then threw a grenade in the tunnel, killing everyone except Kong, who was injured by shrapnel and still bears a scar next to his left eye. When we sat down, Kong thanked me for coming to the museum, for sharing the pain of our people. He had told me it had been a complete surprise when the troops entered the village. No one fought back, he said. After 4 hours, they killed the entire village and withdrew, leaving our village full of blood and fire. Kong's full-time job is to make sure the massacre is not forgotten. For Americans, My Lai was supposed to be a never-again moment. In 1969, the anti-war movement turned one of Haberle's photographs of dead women and children into a poster overlaid with a short, chilling quote from Medlow, "And babies." It was largely because of My Lai that returning Vietnam veterans were widely derided as baby killers. Even decades later, military personnel used the massacre as a cautionary tale, a reminder of what can happen when young soldiers unleash their rage on civilians. "No My Lies in this division, do you hear me?" Major General Ronald Griffith told his brigade commanders before entering battle in Persian Gulf War. Yet Kong and the other survivors are painfully aware that all the soldiers involved in the massacre went free. The only one convicted was released after a brief and comfortable captivity. I asked Kong whether he would welcome a visit from Cali. For Vietnamese people who know, when a person knows his sin, he or she must repent, pray, and acknowledge in front of the spirits, Kong told me. Then he will be forgiven and his mind will be relaxed. Indeed, the home of every survivor I interviewed had an altar in the living room where incense was burned and offerings were made to help the living venerate dead family members. Seems unlikely that Cali will make that trip. Smithsonian offered him the opportunity to accompany me to Vietnam and he declined. If Mr. Cali does not return to Vietnam to repent and apologize to the 504 spirits who were killed, Kong told me, he will always be haunted, constantly obsessed until he dies, and even when he dies, he won't be at peace. So I hope he will come to Vietnam. Those 504 spirits will forgive his sins, his ignorant mind that caused their death. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.